Have you ever wondered what happens to an airplane when it sinks into water so cold and so dark that even the light gives up trying to reach the bottom? I'm Taildragger, and you're listening to The Hangar on Radio Hangar. Pull up a chair because this one has everything: a bomber, a frozen lock, a crew that walked away, and 45 years of silence before anyone went back to find her. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at aviationsoul.com. Now let's set the scene. It's New Year's Eve, 1940. Britain is barely holding on. The Luftwaffe has been hammering London for months, and Bomber Command is scrambling to train crews fast enough to hit back. Up in the Scottish Highlands, Royal Air Force Lossiemouth is one of those training bases where young men learn to fly the heaviest machines in the inventory. The Vickers Wellington, if you've never seen one up close, let me paint the picture. She's a twin-engine medium bomber, fabric over a geodetic lattice frame designed by Barnes Wallace. That's the same Barnes Wallace who later dreamed up the bouncing bomb for the Dambuster raids. The geodetic structure was brilliant. Imagine a basket weave of aluminum alloy strips crossing over each other in a diamond pattern, and then the whole thing wrapped in Irish linen doped tight. The result was an airframe that could absorb punishment that would tear a conventional monocoque apart. Wellingtons came home with holes big enough to climb through, pieces of the geodetic frame could be shot away entirely, and the loads would redistribute through the remaining lattice. Crews loved her for that. This particular Wellington was a Mark 1A, serial number N2980, and she was assigned to number 20 Operational Training Unit. Her job that winter evening was a routine navigation exercise over the Scottish Highlands. Nothing dramatic. Fly the route, practice the fixes, bring the crew home. Six men aboard: pilot, co-pilot, navigator, wireless operator, and two gunners. Young men, most of them, learning the trade that would send them over Hamburg and Essen and the Ruhr Valley if they survived the training. They took off from Lossiemouth as the last daylight faded. December 31st, cold, the kind of cold that turns your breath into ice crystals the moment it leaves your lips. The Wellington climbed out to the south, droning over the Cairngorms, that great granite spine of the Scottish Highlands. Now here's where it gets interesting. Somewhere over the Great Glen, something went wrong. The details are a little hazy after all these decades, but the most reliable accounts point to engine trouble. One of those Bristol Pegasus radials, the 18-cylinder twin-row power plants that gave the Wellington her voice, started running rough. Maybe a magneto, maybe oil starvation in the cold. Whatever it was, the pilot found himself losing altitude over some of the most unforgiving terrain in Scotland, mountains in every direction. No airfield within gliding distance, and below him, stretching out long and black in the winter darkness, Loch Ness. Now if you've got to ditch an airplane, a body of fresh water is better than a mountainside, but Loch Ness is no ordinary lake. She's 23 miles long but barely a mile wide in most places, and she's deep, staggeringly deep, over 750 feet at her deepest point. The water temperature hovers around 42 degrees Fahrenheit year-round, fed by peat-stained rivers that turn the water the color of strong tea. Below about 15 or 20 feet, the visibility drops to nothing, absolute blackness. That's why nobody has ever found the monster down there. And it's why the Wellington would stay hidden for nearly half a century. The pilot brought her down on the surface of the loch somewhere near Urquhart Bay, on the western shore. Imagine that moment. The cockpit lit by nothing but instrument glow, the black water rushing up, the belly of the Wellington touching the surface and the spray erupting in sheets on either side, freezing cold water hammering against the fuselage. The airplane skidded forward, slowing fast, and somehow held together, the geodetic frame flexing and absorbing the impact the way Barnes Wallace designed it to. All six crew members got out, every single one. They scrambled through hatches and onto the wings as the water began pouring in through every seam and rivet hole. The Wellington floated for a few minutes, maybe longer, buoyed by whatever air was trapped inside. Long enough for the crew to deploy the emergency dinghy and paddle clear. They were picked up by a boat from the shore. Cold, soaking wet, probably terrified, but alive. And behind them, slowly, quietly, the Wellington settled into the loch. The nose went first, then the tail lifted briefly as the fuselage filled, and then she was gone. Swallowed by that black peat water as if she had never existed. New Year's Eve, 1940, the war still had 4.5 years to run. Nobody was going to go looking for a training airplane at the bottom of a Scottish loch. There were more pressing things to worry about, and so N2980 sat, year after year, decade after decade. Above her, the world changed. The war ended. Jets replaced propellers, men walked on the moon, and Loch Ness became famous for something else entirely. Tourists came from all over the world to look for a monster in the deep water, never knowing that a perfectly good Wellington bomber was already down there, resting in the silt at about 230 feet. Now in the early 1970s, a man named Robin Holmes entered the story. Holmes was a salvage diver and an aviation enthusiast, and he'd heard the stories about the Wellington and the Loch. He started researching, dug through Air Ministry records, talked to locals who remembered the night the bomber came down, and in 1976 he found her. Think about what that must have been like. Descending through that black water with nothing but a dive light cutting a narrow cone of visibility in the peat darkness. 200 feet down, the pressure building in your ears. And then, emerging from the murk like a ghost, the unmistakable silhouette of a Wellington bomber. The wings still spread, the engines still hanging in their nacelles, the geodetic frame visible through gaps in the deteriorated fabric covering. She was sitting upright on the lock bed, slightly nose down, as if she'd just landed and was waiting for someone to come refuel her. Holmes knew immediately that this was something extraordinary. The cold, fresh, oxygen-poor water of Loch Ness had done what no museum could have done. It had preserved the aircraft in remarkable condition. Salt water would have eaten her alive in a few years. But fresh water, near freezing, with almost no current and no light to drive biological growth, had held the Wellington in a kind of suspended animation. But getting her out was another matter entirely. It took Holmes nearly a decade to secure the permissions, the funding, and the engineering expertise to attempt a recovery. The Brooklands Museum in Surrey, which sat on the site of the old Vickers factory, where Wellingtons had actually been built during the war, agreed to take the aircraft if she could be raised. That gave the project a home and a purpose. The recovery operation finally happened in September of 1985, and it was a piece of engineering that would have impressed Barnes Wallace himself. The team used inflatable lifting bags, massive rubberized bladders that could be filled with compressed air at depth. Divers went down in near-zero visibility and attached the bags to the strongest structural points on the airframe. The geodetic frame, battered as it was, still had enough integrity to bear the loads. That's the thing about the Wellington's design. Even after 45 years underwater, the fundamental engineering was sound. They inflated the bags gradually, coaxing the aircraft off the bottom inch by inch, letting the silt release its grip. Clouds of peat billowed up and turned the already dark water into absolute soup. The divers worked by feel, their gloved hands tracing the shapes of the geodetic lattice, the engine cowlings, the turret rings. And slowly, impossibly slowly, N2980 began to rise. When she broke the surface of Loch Ness in September 1985, it was the first time sunlight had touched that airframe since December 31, 1940, 44 years, 9 months, and change. The water streamed off the geodetic skeleton and the remnants of the fabric covering, and there she was. Wounded, fragile, but recognizable, a Wellington bomber, back from the deep. Now, I've talked to folks who were there that day, and they all say the same thing. Nobody spoke for a few seconds. You're looking at an airplane that flew in a war that most of the people present were too young to remember, and yet there it is, dripping wet, real as the ground under your feet, the smell of peat and cold water, the creaking of the recovery crane, and this machine from another era hanging in the air like a time traveler caught between worlds. They put her on a barge and moved her down the Caledonian Canal to the sea, then around the coast and up the Thames to Surrey. It was a journey of several hundred miles, and the Wellington made it on a flatbed barge, strapped down and covered, drawing stairs from every bridge and lockkeeper along the way. At Brooklands, the real work began, and here's where the restoration story turns from adventure into something more like devotion. Because the Brooklands Museum team and their volunteers didn't just want to stick the Wellington in a corner and put a plaque on it. They wanted to bring her back to a state where you could walk up to her and understand what she was, what she meant. What it felt like to climb aboard one of these machines and fly into the dark, over-occupied Europe. The challenge was enormous. The fabric covering was almost entirely gone. The geodetic frame was intact in some sections and collapsed in others. The instrument panel had been stripped by the cold water of most of its readable markings. The engines were seized solid. The turrets were jammed, and the entire airframe was saturated with peat water that had to be carefully removed without causing the aluminum to crumble. They spent years on it. Decades, really. Volunteers came in on weekends, retired engineers who had worked at Vickers in the 50s and 60s, who knew the geodetic structure from the inside out, because they'd built the later Varsity and Valletta aircraft that used similar principles. They straightened individual lattice members by hand. They fabricated replacement sections using the original Vickers drawings, which they tracked down in archives that hadn't been opened since the war. They rebuilt the instrument panel using photographs from the Imperial War Museum. The Bristol Pegasus engines were disassembled, cleaned, measured, and reassembled. Not to run, mind you. Nobody was trying to fly this airplane, but to show the engineering. To let you stand in front of that cowling and see the 9 cylinders of the front row and understand the mechanical elegance of a radial engine that produced 1,000 horsepower from a design that dated back to the early 1930s. And here's the part that always gets me. As they worked on the restoration, they found things, personal things, a pencil stub wedged behind a structural member, a fragment of a map case, the remnants of a thermos flask, small ordinary objects that suddenly carry the weight of human presence. Some young navigator had tucked that pencil behind a frame member during a training flight 80 years ago, and there it was, waiting. The Brooklyn's Museum Wellington is now the centerpiece of the aircraft factory exhibit. She's displayed in a purpose-built hangar on the same ground, where Wellingtons rolled off the Vickers production line during the war. There's something almost sacred about that. She was born there, went off to war, ended up at the bottom of a Scottish loch, and came home, full circle. And she's the only intact Wellington recovered from the war era. Think about that for a moment. Vickers built over 11,300 Wellingtons during the war. 11,300 Wellingtons during the war. 11,300. She was the backbone of Bomber Command in the early years, the airplane that carried the fight to Germany when the Lancasters and Halifaxes were still on the drawing board. And today, this one airframe from the bottom of Loch Ness is the best surviving example of all 11,000 of her sisters. Robin Holmes, the diver who found her and spent a decade getting her out, received the British Empire Medal for his efforts, rightfully so. Without his stubbornness and his refusal to let the bureaucracy win, N2980 would still be sitting in the dark at 230 feet, slowly dissolving into the peat. You know, I think about restoration projects like this and what they really mean. It's not just about the airplane. It's about the thread that connects us to the people who built her, flew her, and climbed out of her onto the freezing surface of a Scottish loch on the last night of 1940. Every straightened lattice member, every cleaned rivet, every hour that a volunteer spent on a Saturday morning in a Surrey workshop is an act of remembrance. Not the kind you do once a year with a wreath and a bugle, the kind you do with your hands. If you ever find yourself within driving distance of Brooklyn's Museum, go see her, stand under that geodetic frame, and look up at the diamond pattern of aluminum alloy that Barnes Wallace dreamed up, and think about the fact that it survived a ditching, 45 years in a lock, a recovery operation, and decades of painstaking restoration. And it's still holding together. That story came from research across the Brooklyn's Museum archives, Robin Holmes' own accounts of the recovery, and the RAF historical records at the National Archives in Kew. If you want to see the Wellington yourself, Brooklyn's is just south of Weybridge, in Surrey. Worth the trip. I'm Tail Dragger. Thanks for sitting in the hangar with me. Until next time, keep the nose into the wind and go see the real thing when you can. Nothing beats standing next to the actual machine. More stories waiting for you at radiohangar.com.